But now on Radio 4, the world's great whales have been protected from hunters for 24 years, but they're still suffering from man's exploitation of the sea. In Costing the Earth Now, Tom Heap asks how we can all help to save the whale.
There's people cheering. The man has actually got into the water now and he's throwing water at the whale to try and get the whale away from the shallow waters and back into the deeper parts of the Thames.
I heard about it on the radio, just popped down to have a look at it. It was such a beautiful animal. It was just wonderful to be that close to it. It really was.
There's something about the almost human qualities of whales and dolphins that seems to touch us. That plucky fight of the Thames whale brought thousands to the riverbank and its tragic demise, tears to their eyes. And yet, across the globe, we're engaged in an accidental war of attrition against marine mammals. They're poisoned by our chemicals, trapped in our fishing nets, and often fatally confused by our noise. And next month, the international body which governs whaling may be overtaken by those who actually want to resume hunting. In tonight's Costing the Earth, we look at the threats to sea mammals and what's being done to help them. From literally putting your arms around them,
and then all of a sudden you will just get this incredible feeling of power and the animal will just rush out of your arm.
To the controversial idea of deliberately exposing wild whales to noise like this. As we'll find out, scientists believe this brief discomfort could prove a long-term lifesaver.
I'm approaching some 20-foot-high red doors in South London, and what's inside gives a clue to why they're so big, because this is the Natural History Museum's mammal store, and they have some very big beasts in here. Not only things like elephants, but also whales. I guess you need a big door to get them through there. And behind this one is Richard Sabin, who is the Natural History Museum zoologist who's most interested in whales. Would you be Richard?
Yes,
sir. Hi, I'm Tom from Costing the Earth.
Hi.
Nice to see you. That is amazing. Lined with, what have we got, impala, or I don't know, some kind of deer species on this side?
Yeah, sable antelope, roan antelope on this side, plus about 60 or 70 different species. What you're looking at on the right-hand side are the skulls and skeletons of Asian elephants? And African elephants, that's right, yeah.
I don't think anything else had a skull that big, except for I was thinking maybe whales, which is presumably where we're headed off to, are we?
Yeah.
I love this place. I think it might appeal to the old Scooby-Doo episode in me. There's a certain mystery about these places, isn't there? Do you get a bit spooked wandering around here at night?
Or? I don't, no. I find it quite a calming atmosphere, to be quite honest with you.
The whole elephant skeleton here... Some kind of ox head there. Amazing. Ah, what have we here?
Right, this next room that we're passing into, this is the what we call the Cetacea collection, the collection of skeletons of whales, dolphins and porpoises, and there's about 2,500 in here.
2,500?
Yeah, we've got four banks of cabinets at the end of the room which have the skeletons of the smaller species, but the collection's been put together over a period of about, actually, 400 to 500 years. 1575 were the earliest skull specimens that were collected in the Channel Islands, actually. We've got the lower jaw on the back wall of a sperm whale that was actually on display at the Great Exhibition in the Crystal Palace in 1851. And believe it or not, this jaw was part of the British Industry exhibition that was in the hall. Not there for natural history purposes, this was to demonstrate to people the new whaling ships that were being produced could actually go further and take bigger animals.
And is it this one here?
And this is it, yeah.
Oh, yeah, it actually says, Great Exhibition, 1851. I'll probably get the pronunciation of this. Is it Physeter catadon? Is that
Physeter catadon.
Is that sperm whale in,
that's right, yeah.
In science? Was this where it's caught, South Sea, between Cape Howe and New Zealand?
That's right, that's right.
That was, of course, at a time when we were proud to catch whales and liked to boast about it at great exhibitions for their industrial use.
Exactly. I mean, it was a time when the full impact of what was going on, the commercial exploitation of these large species, wasn't really fully appreciated, so they were just another commercial resource.
The great days of the whaling industry ended in 1982, when the members of the International Whaling Commission agreed to halt commercial hunting. It was a conservation triumph. The whale, it seemed, was safe at last. Next month, the IWC has its annual meeting in the Caribbean, There, Japan, which has never actually given up what it calls scientific whaling, looks set to take control of the IWC and could begin to turn the clock back. Vasily Papastravo will be there trying to stop them. He's from the International Fund for Animal Welfare.
This could be the most important International Whaling Commission meeting since the moratorium was adopted in 1982, but for all the wrong reasons. Catches of whales are increasing dramatically. Japan is about to take over the IWC and control it with a simple majority block of countries, and we could see whaling legitimised in a way that we haven't seen since the 1970s.
People believe that protection of whales has been a kind of success story in the last 25 years. Rightly or wrongly, I think that's an impression. Are you saying that could be about to end?
I think we have been victims of our own success. So from really high commercial catches in the 1970s, after the moratorium was adopted, we got down to a catch of round about 329 whales in 1989. But we're now looking at catches within the next 12 months of almost 10 times that figure.
So you think already the impression that we're doing well and no need to worry is wrong?
Most definitely.
And if that's wrong already, how much worse could it get after June?
I would predict a gradual slide towards increased catches, with each year more and more whales being taken, and each year governments essentially accepting, in the way that they accepted in 1989 that 300 whales were going to be taken, accepting in future years that 10,000 whales will be taken or 20,000 whales will be taken.
We've now come to the laboratory of the Zoological Society of London, which is inside London Zoo. And with me is Dr. Paul Jepson. Now, Paul, you've been putting on a white coat and shoes. Why do we need this here?
Well, we need this because we're about to enter the post-mortem examination room. And of course, all carcasses of animals can have pathogens that could be, you know, a threat to human health. So we need to wear all the protective clothing and follow all the proper procedures.
Now, while I'm getting suited and booted then, through the glass there, I can see one of those metal tables. This is actually an autopsy room, is it?
That's right, yes. Yes, indeed.
And what kind of work do you carry out here?
Well, the work that we carry out here is funded by the UK government and is to conduct post-mortem examinations of stranded marine mammals, particularly cetaceans, the whales, dolphins and porpoises that strand all around the coast of the United Kingdom.
Scramble past the wellies and the shower. From your work on strandings and the autopsies connected with those, what have you been able to see about the causes of death of stranded cetaceans and how they're changing?
Well, there's been concern for decades now about the impact of particularly organochlorine pollutants, and these are things like pesticides like DDT, and particularly polychlorinated biphenyls, which were used for many years as sort of, you know, in various industrial processes or electrical equipment. And they have two properties that make them particularly a threat to marine mammals. They're very persistent, so they don't break down in the environment. And the second is because they...
So just to be clear about that, it means it can be emitted from a chimney in or near London and end up anywhere in the world without ever...
That's right, yes. Right. I mean, you've got, you know, pesticides and PCBs in Arctic species and in Antarctic, you know, where very, you know, little production or use has been deployed, but they literally can sort of distill on a global basis. And once they're in the environment, they don't break down, you know, they're not broken down by bacteria or easily metabolized by many species. And because they're very fat soluble, they readily dissolve in fat tissue, so that means that in the very lowest layers of the food chain they can start to accumulate as bigger animals eat smaller animals and so on. As you get, by the time you get to the top of the food chain where you have bottlenose dolphins and killer whales, that the levels can be extraordinarily high, and I think probably some of the highest levels ever recorded on Earth have been in the marine mammals. So
these could be accounting for the large numbers, large percentages of marine mammal deaths.
We've done a lot of research on harbour porpoises in the UK, and we've compared porpoises that died, that were healthy but died of traumatic causes like bycatch or being walloped by a bottlenose dolphin, and that's our control group. And then we've compared the mean level of PCBs in those healthy animals to those that died of the various infectious diseases. And we know from experimental work that PCBs can suppress the immune system. And what we found is there's significantly higher levels of PCBs in the disease group compared to the control group that died of physical traumas.
So just to spell that out, what you suspect PCBs may be doing is in effect weakening the marine mammal population, making them more prone to disease.
We suspect that these PCBs are probably one of the mechanisms involved in the decline.
I'm just walking up to a building facing the beach at St Andrews on the North Sea coast of Scotland, and there's a garage roller door. I think our interviewees are behind this. Oh, inside it's more of a storeroom. It's got everything. It's full of outboard motors, rubber boats, big old tractor here. And somewhere in here I'm going to find Douglas Gillespie and Jonathan Gordon. What is all this stuff for?
Well, this is basically the storeroom for research equipment for the CMR Research Unit. But over in this corner is our hydrophone equipment, which has just come back from a field trial on the Darwin, the Big Nert research vessel.
Out listening for whales and dolphins?
Yes, in that particular case as part of a mitigation measure, because they were using seismic air guns. So we were using these hydrophones to detect whether whales were around before they started using their seismic guns to avoid any risk of damaging or disturbing the animal.
Douglas, I understand that one of the things you're most interested in is right whales and the problems they're having when they come across humans, or perhaps the other way around, I should say.
There's a very small population of right whales left in the North Atlantic, which lives almost exclusively on the east coast of the United States. There's only about between 300 and 350 individuals left of the species, in fact. And the population's known to be in decline. And the main reason for that decline is, in fact, ship strikes. They're hit by ships on quite a regular basis. And that, of course, kills them outright.
Regular basis?
Regular basis. In the 15 months to last summer, there were at least 6 known right whale deaths, and at least 4 of them were known to be ship strikes. And the really sad thing is that 3 of those were pregnant mums with calves. So there's absolute carnage out there for right whales. And
I'm a bit surprised that whales do actually get hit by ships. I mean, I don't want to diss the right whale here, but I would have thought it'd be fairly easy to avoid getting hit by many tens of thousands of tons hunk of metal.
Whales use sound to orientate themselves, and they'll be using sound to know that a ship is in the area. And the sound of an approaching ship is a great big rumbling noise. You know, obviously, we hear them a lot on our own hydrophones. And it's very difficult to know if it's a ship which is going to hit you head on, or if it's a ship which is going to go sort of half a mile away. And the sound field is going to sound almost exactly the same for those two situations.
Really?
Until absolutely the last minute. And by then it's quite possibly too late for the whale to take evasive action.
Well, talking about sound, Jonathan Gordon, much of your recent work has been about sound, is that right?
That's right, yes.
And you've got a CD here. Is this the sort of thing I can put in my hi-fi?
It's what a fairly large ship sounds like at a range of about 5 miles in the ocean.
Really? You can kind of still hear that churning propeller. Is that what I can hear?
Hundreds. I don't think there's anywhere, certainly in the North Atlantic, where you wouldn't hear ship noise.
Do we know that these sounds upset whales?
Noise from vessels in the ocean has increased overall what we call ambient noise levels in the ocean. And that's not really the sound of an individual ship. That's all of the sound of all of the ships accumulating over time and sort of reverberating around the ocean. And we also know that some species of whales, such as the blue whale, communicate over enormous distances of possibly hundreds or even thousands of kilometres. And it's sort of quite sort of straightforward physics, really, just to know that if noise levels have increased, the range at which you can detect those sounds goes down.
If I understand it correctly, whales use sound as their principal means of receiving and data, or certainly over long distances, a bit like we use sight. So if you get a lot of sound in the ocean, it's a bit like us living in permanent fog. We can't see far.
Exactly, yes. There's a researcher in the United States has described all the noise from ships as acoustic fog. And it's pretty straightforward, really. If a blue whale could communicate over whatever range it was, it can now communicate with a tenth of the number of other animals, because the area that it can communicate over has gone down by a factor of 10. So if you're, say, looking for a mate, and you can sing a song to attract, which may potentially be heard by 100 females, it will now only be heard by 10 females. But that effect, combined with the reduced population caused by commercial whaling in the earlier part of the last century, could still be having a serious effect on the rate at which those populations are recovering.
There are fewer mates and they're more difficult to find.
Exactly.
We heard the ship noise there, Douglas, and the extraordinary news that that propeller sound can be heard from 5 miles away. Is that the only kind of sound in the oceans? What other things are out there?
There are many other noises that we make in the ocean. There's seismic survey noise. That's where we're deliberately making a very loud sound and bouncing it through the seabed, usually in the search for fossil fuels, though often for other scientific research purposes. And then, of course, there's military sonar, where, again, we're generating a noise which we'll hope will bounce off some distant object, such as a submarine. Then by analysing the echo, we can detect the presence of that submarine.
Oh, wow. Although we can't listen with a whale's ears, do we think that's kind of as... I mean, it's a very piercing noise to us. Do we think that is for them as well?
Well, at the time, we were looking at some pilot whales quite opportunistically, which were behaving very strangely and were responding to this sonar vocally. And you couldn't imagine anything more dramatic than, you know, a dozen big animals coming up on a beach in conjunction with something as obvious as a military exercise. But it wasn't until the late 90s that anybody actually published the suggestion that there was this causal effect. And it's only been in the last 5 years or so when some very dramatic examples in the Bahamas and the Canaries have been very well studied that everyone has sort of accepted that this is happening.
Could I just get you to explain how it is thought sonar is causing whales, particularly beaked whales, to die?
What researchers from the UK and from the Canaries found in the cadavers they looked at in the Canaries are symptoms which were consistent with a decompression sickness, what in humans we'd call the bends. So that's led to a suggestion their diving pattern is changed and that they then go on to develop decompression sickness, and that's what ultimately kills them. The source that they use sounds just like killer whales. So there's an obvious mechanism there that, for some reason, beaked whales are particularly frightened of killer whales, and it could be something as simple as that.
So just to be clear, you're saying, as far as you can tell, to a beaked whale, a military sonar sounds like a killer whale, which is its most feared predator.
That's one suggestion, and it's a very obvious, very obvious hypothesis.
Yeah, that's like us walking through a wood and hearing baying wolves, isn't it? I mean, it's primal.
Yes.
And away from the storeroom here at the Sea Mammals Research Unit, we can find another man working on how we impact on whales, and that's Simon Northridge. He's looking at fishing.
Yeah, I would say that fishing is probably the major cause of casualties from marine mammals around the world. We've estimated that probably somewhere in excess of 300,000 marine mammals globally get killed in fishing operations every year. There are in Japan a wide variety of fisheries, but certain of them do seem to have reasonably large bycatches or accidental catches of whales in particular. These get reported every year to the International Whaling Commission, and typically in recent years there's been more than 100 minke whales, for example, which get taken in a particular type of fishery in Japan. I mean, these are normally nets that are just set out in the water to catch fish, and they're left in the same place, and the whales seem to blunder into them.
What about the waters around here? How is fishing impacting on our whales?
Well, we do get a few records every year of, I'm talking about northwestern Europe now, of whales that have been entangled in fishing gear. Curiously enough, the thing that seems to affect them most is actually lobster pots and pot fisheries, fishing for lobsters and crabs. Whales, when they're swimming in an area where there's a lot of these things, there are vertical ropes going up to the surface from the seabed. Up to the buoy at the surface, indeed. And they do seem to sometimes get themselves tangled up in that.
You're listening to Costing the Earth on BBC Radio 4. And so far we've been listing the charges that humans might face on abuse of marine mammals, whales and dolphins, and the sheet is looking pretty stiff. We seem to be maiming them accidentally in fishing nets, poisoning them, disorientating them with sounds they're not used to, and then we come to hunting. So is it all bad? Are we actually doing anything to help? Well, here on Folkestone Beach, I'm joined by a couple of guys who have certainly been doing their bit to help. Mark Stevens and Jason Carter. What is it you do?
We rescue whales and dolphins. We run an organisation that rescues them all around the coast of Britain 24/7.
you were involved in the Thames Whale, weren't you?
Yeah, we our organisation, British Divers Marine Life Rescue, were the lead organisation there.
What's your top memory of it?
The response of the people of London and the support that they gave us, and I was particularly proud of the way that our medics worked.
But the actual reason you got me here down on Folkestone Beach, next to an inflatable whale, is so I can gain a fraction of your skill. What are we actually going to be doing today?
Today we're going to show you how we would assess and carry out first aid and then hopefully refloat and release a stranded whale from a beach.
We're here on the south coast on Folkestone Beach. This is not an area I associate with marine mammals, whales and dolphins.
Well, we thought you'd probably say that, and that's why we arranged to bring you all the way to Folkestone, because if you just look out there 300 yards, there's a bottlenose dolphin swimming around.
You're joking.
No, he's out there, you'll see him surface, and he's been here for just over a week now.
Really?
Key factor today is keeping the animal wet, so if Jason, you can get a watering can.
Why is that so important?
It's to keep the try and keep the animal as cool as possible, and it's also so we can prevent the skin from drying out. A whale's skin is incredibly delicate and will very quickly dry out and start to slough off.
And you just pour it on gently?
Pour it on. That's it, and just get it on. The other thing you do, and particularly important on a sandy beach, is to flush the eyes out with water. And then if you're really concerned, you can get some of this jelly and you put a big gob of it on your hand and just do that and put a film of it onto the eye.
Do they not, you know, react and go, oh my God, I've got someone's trying to stick something in my eye?
Well, it will affect their breathing rate. The stress level on dolphins is assessed by how many breaths a minute they're actually breathing. And if they're into double figures, it's stress, and single figures is not so bad. Whales' tears are very viscous anyway and very thick, so this thin film over their eyes is pretty much akin to their own tears anyway, and they produce a really copious tear stream.
And whales' tears.
Yeah, I've got a really lovely photograph of it, and it's a really good one for when you do a talk at the Women's Institute, you know, and you finish your talk on the crying whale and they all get their purses out. It's really good.
Yeah, get me, I tell you. But we're working on the assumption that this one is worth saving, I
indeed,
think,
indeed. And he can go out and join his mate out there, can't he?
Yeah, who I just saw, actually. Yeah. Just as you were talking, right behind him. Anyway.
So what you need to do is just to come round, get hold of your side of the mat.
I guess it sounds obvious, but you lift the mat rather than lift the animal.
You're going to turn around 180 degrees face the sea. You're going to go out into the sea. And you would walk out into chest depth water.
Right.
So we take it out to a fair depth of water. So if we do that, okay, so on three. One, two, three. Turning round. And you can walk in. And I warn you, it's quite a shelving beach here. It goes away very quickly. This might go on for 2 or 3 hours. And with any degree of luck, the animal will start to swim gently.
Well, what does that feel like?
That's fantastic. It's the best feeling you can have, you know, after flogging yourself to death on a sunny beach all day. And it's a success, it's fantastic.
Well, I do feel after that bracing dip, I could at least help in rescuing a stranded whale. But what about the other threats? Things like PCBs, well, they're the really dangerous chemical, and that's already out there in the water. Changing the habits of fishermen is a long and painful process. But what about underwater sound? Can we reduce that? Well, one of the guys from the Sea Mammal Research Unit who we met earlier, Jonathan Gordon, thinks we can if we're brave.
We want these sound producers to change the way they produce sounds or indeed change their sound sources. We need some evidence, some hard evidence, to show that the expense of doing that and the inconvenience of doing that will actually have a real benefit for the animals.
Well, that's really fascinating, the idea of controlled exposure experiments, because if I've understood you correctly, it's... the practicalities of it are pretty complicated, and the ethics could be quite challenging as well, couldn't they?
What one would aim to do then is to collect baseline data, so one knew what the animal's behaviour was before that, and then expose it to the noise, obviously initially at very low levels, below the level at which you were expecting to see an effect, and then observe what the animal does.
Then, in effect, you're turning up the volume or changing the intensity until you can see some reaction, some evidence of stress in the animal.
That's right. Not really evidence of stress. I mean, stress is much more difficult to measure, but really a behavioural reaction. very often in science, one has to do things which involve a risk. And sometimes one's taking that risk on just for, if you like, just for scientific interest. Well, here's a case where we know what the consequence is of not solving this problem. And the consequence is many tens, perhaps hundreds of beaked whales dying every year. And there could be other species that we don't know about.
Cruel to be kind.
Yes, if you like. But I still wouldn't say it's cruel. I think cruel is a very loaded word. But taking a small risk to avoid a large known problem. To me, as a conservationist as well as a scientist, it's ironic that some of the groups that I would have hoped would have seen the benefit of this and been supportive of the idea of controlled exposures have actually been blocking this, especially in the States. So they really focus on the what I think are the small risks.
These are animal welfare groups and conservation groups,
and I think some are just anti-military groups more than pro-whale mm-hmm. groups. But that's sort of created a climate under which a lot of the people who would have funded this sort of research are unwilling or scared of funding it. And also some of the scientists who would like to do this or are capable of doing this are not so keen, partly because they can often get involved in lawsuits in the States. And, you know, some of them have even been threatened. So it's,
really?
Yes.
It's reached that pitch in America, has it?
It has with some groups in the States, yes.
So while whale lovers can easily unite behind the cry to keep the hunting ban, reducing accidental threats is more divisive. But as we're concerned about the overall survival and vigour of our sea mammals, the biggest killers surely need the greatest attention. Whales, dolphins and porpoises are dying as collateral damage to our exploitation of the oceans. We could do more to avoid this, more than just guiding the occasional obvious casualty back to the water.
We've now slowly waddled out to about chest depth of water. That's me and Jason holding hands underneath our whale, making sure she's happy.
I look at it from my point of view, I'm the top of my food chain and they're most certainly the top of their food chain. And certainly anything that happens to them now is likely to befall upon us in the next few hundred years. So I think if we can look after our top predators as a top predator, we're likely to survive ourselves.
Ready, 3, 2, 1, go. And Nicole, I've got to watch out for the tail. There she goes.
Costing the Earth was presented by Tom Heap and produced by Alistair Cross, and the programme returns later in the summer.